Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Real quick before we start the show, just wanted to let you guys know you can get the show 2 days early by joining our Patreon. Even for a buck, you can listen to the show 2 days early. Go to patreon.com/analogtalk and we got a bunch of stuff over there. Check it out and enjoy the episode.
Hey you guys, welcome back to another episode of Analog Talk, a film photography podcast. I'm your host, Tim.
I'm Chris.
And on today's show, we have James Hamilton. Hey James.
Hi James.
Hi, how are you?
Good. We're beyond honored to have you on our show today. We're very excited about your new documentary that's coming out. But before we get into all of it, do you mind introducing yourself to our listeners and telling us how you got into photography? Well, I guess we'll start there.
we got
a lot to talk about.
Yeah, I'm James Hamilton. I live in New York City. Have lived here. I went to college at Pratt Institute for a couple of years and wound up moving to this apartment in the summer, on the summer of 66, just because I didn't want to go back home to Connecticut.
Yeah.
That summer. And I had to get a job. And I was studying painting and at Pratt, and I was always going to be some sort of an artist. Mm. And so I had to get a job to pay for this $109 apartment.
Wow.
And I had two roommates, who high school chums.
Jeez.
Three of us living here. You know, you could do that in the 60s.
Yeah.
We all had jobs, but I had to get one. So through a friend of a friend, I heard about a fashion photographer who needed an assistant. And I said, well, I don't know anything about photography. And they said, well, I'll go see him anyway. He was just starting out in New York. His name was Alberto Rizzo. He was a Roman, fantastic guy. I went up to introduce myself to him, and I didn't even know what a strobe was.
Whoa.
And it was a studio job, so I had I kind of bluffed my way through it, but we hit it off so well because we seemed to like all the same things, all the same movies, things like that. And so in conversation, we had a great time, and he hired me on the spot. So I basically learned on the job how to use a camera, his camera, work in the darkroom, and he shot mostly color, but a lot of black and white, and I had to develop it all. So I developed develop all the black and white, and I learned how to print. So it was all learning on the job that summer, and by the end of it, I decided that I would stay with him and not go back to Pratt.
Wow.
So I decided, I guess I'll try to be a photographer. Because I borrowed his camera, went out on the street, and spent that whole summer working for him and taking pictures in the street. I knew did not want to be a fashion photographer. I had no feel for that.
Right.
But I loved taking pictures in the street and wandering around, mostly Manhattan, but the boroughs as well. And just fell in love with it. So, and I got to develop all my film in his darkroom.
Oh, that's a perk.
Yeah. So that was, it was a real perk. And also use it for printing and everything. So, because I didn't have a darkroom here. I had one later, but I didn't have one here in my apartment. So I had access to his. It was great. a wonderful guy. And yeah, I stayed with him for 2 years.
Wow.
What was he shooting? Was he shooting like medium format, large format, or what?
He was shooting, he loved the Hasselblad.
Yep.
But he also loved, he coveted my camera. I the first camera I bought was a Nikon rangefinder. Are you familiar with that?
Yep. Oh, okay. Yep. The S, I believe, is that?
It wasn't a Nikon F, but it was
the
Nikon rangefinder. But I was never comfortable with the rangefinder, and he coveted that camera. And so basically I traded it with him for his Nikon F.
Man.
Which I totally fell in love with, because I was not comfortable with rangefinder focusing.
Right.
It was difficult for me. I know a lot of people say that, you know, use Leicas because they found it so fast to focus.
Yeah.
But I didn't. And I like seeing the whole image. Doing what you had to do.
Yeah, it can be tough. Yeah.
But most people found it very fast. I didn't. So I fell in love with the Nikon F, and that was the camera I used from the beginning up until mid-80s.
Wow. I love a good workhorse camera, you know?
It's a beautiful camera. I have several bodies, and I like the black one, which is what I had.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And I would use an on-camera flash for everything. I started with this tiny little Vivitar, and then I wound up using a Sunpak, which I don't know if you... There was one where you could... I have to demonstrate now. But you could turn the... Mm-hmm. You know what I'm talking about? You could turn it this way and bounce it all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So talk to us about the cross-country trip to where...
Oh, well, what? Well, so after I worked with him for 2 years, my girlfriend and I split up, and I decided that I would... I was totally free, and so I decided I would spend the summer of 69... hitchhiking around the country.
Wow!
So I got one of those old Lloyd bulk loaders, and I got 100-foot rolls of film and a backpack, and traveled very light. I would bulk load film in gas station bathrooms in the dark, and I just took pictures all across the country for what turned out to be 5 months.
Wow,
man!
So it was the summer into the fall. And in the process, joined with a girl, and we hitchhiked for a number of those months together.
Man, definitely not something you can do now.
No, oh, no, you'd
I'd be
murdered.
Terrified. I'd be terrified.
At the same time, you could not do that now. It was 69.
Well, yeah, what a time, huh?
The summer of Woodstock, and actually, we went to a rock and roll festival in Texas while we were on this trip. And I went to a stationery store and I forged, basically put together.
I love this story.
Forged
this story.
There was a magazine called Show Magazine at the time that I knew nobody would ever check with.
Yeah.
So smart. I wrote that we were working for Show Magazine. So they put us up front all 3 days of this festival. Wow. And a lot of the acts from Woodstock were there, including Janis Joplin. I don't know if Johnny Winter was there, but Johnny Winter was at the show.
Wow.
And lots of terrific people. B.B. King, I could go on. But so I took pictures of all these acts. And they were part of the enormous amount of film that I came back to New York with.
What's crazy about that story is because you could not do that today, because somebody would instantly get on their phone or their computer you know, like, it's just like these opportunities, you can't have them now. And that's just so incredible to what a great idea to just be like, you know what, I'll fake a pass and we'll go.
Yeah.
And like, who's going to tell us? No.
Right. Well, it was
amazing.
A lot looser in those days. Yes.
Yeah.
So how was it? Because you didn't develop everything until you got back, right? How was it carrying all that work with you?
Oh, yeah.
I'll tell you what happened. My camera, at one point, my camera jammed.
Mm.
And I wasn't sure whether I had gotten the past two or three rolls. So I developed them really like in a sort of small drugstore type lab while I was on the road, and they came back, you know, grainy and pretty terribly done. And that was the only time in my life that I ever had anyone else develop my film.
Man, wow. I can relate.
Yeah, I was going to say, sounds familiar.
And it was only because I was worried about what result, you know, was worried about what results I would be getting going forward, for instance. So I wanted to make sure that everything was okay.
That's smart, though. Imagine going that whole trip. Your life would have probably changed completely if...
that's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was grainy, but, you know, it was printable. So, yeah. Anyway, so, yeah, I had an enormous amount of film. It was quite a trip.
I can imagine. Plus,
it was fantastic, really. And it was summer, so it was, you know, manageable.
I'm sure you could even make, like, a little body of work of just that time. Like that trip.
I have, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing. Well, those photos led to your next job, right?
The music photos did, yeah. Because I had heard that a rock and roll paper was starting up called Crawdaddy.
I love that name.
It was originally started by, it was started in, well, I think maybe a year before I went there, which is in 69. And I went there. I processed the film from the Rock and Roll Festival in Texas. Went there with a handful of prints, and they hired me on the spot as the staff photographer. So that was the beginning of my journalism career, which was great. You know, it was a fantastic time to be covering rock and roll. I would go to Film Release every weekend, and you know, photograph all the acts that pass through town. I live right across the street from a place called the Albert Hotel, which was where a lot of, if they didn't stay at the Chelsea, they stayed at the Albert Hotel, and which was, you know, close enough to Fillmore and everything. So I'm in the Village.
Okay.
So I would go across the street and take pictures of people in the hotel there and on the streets and wherever I could. And it was basically, you know, photographing sex, drugs, and rock and roll for...
Yeah.
For a couple of years, for two years and a half, something like
that. So at that hotel, were there a lot of photographers there, or was it kind of you were the guy?
Mostly they would be at Fillmore.
Okay.
They were basically photographing acts on stage. I don't know how many people were actually. I mean, I suppose they would go to the Chelsea sometimes and take pictures, but. But it seemed like most of the pictures came from performance shots in those days.
Did you get, when you were in Texas at that concert, did you get many portraits, or was it mostly just the stage shots?
It was all stage shot. That's all.
Because it seems like the portrait really, really took over for a lot of your work.
Yeah.
Like
I
love your portrait work, especially with the flash, talking about.
Thank you. I mean, I loved what I could manage to get from stage shots, because that was a challenge, really. But I think early on I decided that I would probably be pretty good making portraits. I could experiment a little when I used the studio that I was working in with lights. So I knew enough about lighting that I could get a kit together to take. I never had an assistant, but I had a Volkswagen Camper with press plates, so I could drive around the city. It's the golden ticket in New York to have press plates, because I could park my camper right in front of my apartment building, and I could park anywhere except no standing zones. So I would drive all over the city in this camper and carry my gear and go to hotels or wherever I would, you know, encounter people and set up studios wherever I went. And I actually have a seamless here that I pulled down, and I took a lot of pictures here as well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was always a dream of mine, to have one of those in my apartment.
it's quite wide, and it's just white, but I can tack. I shoot a lot of pictures against black velvet.
Oh, I love it. Yeah.
And I can clip black velvet on there and shoot that way too. But the other thing I do, it's basically black or white. I throw light on the white background to make it pure white, or make it pure black.
Man, and about the black and white too, I wanted to ask you while it's fresh in my head. Was that like a choice? Did you want to be like a black and white photographer? A lot of times you hear it's just because of the cost of color film and processing. And like you said, you have more control.
That kind of factored into it. But most of the media I was involved with, certainly in the early days,
was black and white. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. You know, it was before Crawdaddy was all black and white. And then I worked for a newspaper called The Herald, which was all black and white.
Yep.
It was a Sunday broadsheet newspaper that early on did not have a lot of advertising. So the pictures were gigantic and it was gorgeously designed by a man named Massimo Vignelli, who was quite a famous graphic designer. So actually, I think it won awards. It was so beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
And because there weren't a lot of ads, I could run pictures quite large. I had met Patti Smith in 1970. A poet friend of mine introduced me to her, and I made a portrait of her then. But then that same poet wound up being one of the editors at this newspaper called The Herald.
Yeah.
And he brought her in to do rock and roll criticism and interviews. And so she and I would go out and do interviews together.
Patti Smith.
We met each other.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I met her in December 70 when she was kind of starting out. She hadn't made a record or anything, but
she
was a poet.
Just always thinking of all the print media, it just always makes me so sad that it's just not like that anymore.
Well, I love the film for that reason, it's very much about that,
as you know.
I mean, it really is about the era, and it is... You know, sad that so much of it is gone. Did either of you ever work in for alt media or anything like that?
Closest I got was I used to catch papers off the end of a press back in the day when I first started. I worked in printing, and the first place I worked at was a newspaper place, and I would, you know, catch the papers, band them, and get them ready for the little paper boys. But that was the closest I ever got. I was, you know.
Yeah.
I used to photograph shows. I used to get my press passes via a online magazine where my payment was a ticket. You know, I got free tickets to go shoot the show and then turn the photos over.
I get it.
You know, zero money in that, but it was fun.
You still have the pictures? No?
Yeah, still got the photos. Yep. And all the passes, I have them all stacked up somewhere, like in the little...
Were you shooting color or black and white?
That was digital. I was shooting color because that was my digital era.
Yeah, the only reason I shot black and white was because I was working in newsprint, but because I preferred black and white. I never considered myself a color photographer particularly. But I loved black and white. I mean, the photographs I grew up loving were basically the photographs that portrayed history, and so many of them were black and white. And I love black and white movies. I loved film noir. I just loved black and white much more. And also, I had control over black and white because I had my darkroom, and I never learned to print color, and I didn't really care to anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I was a black and white photographer, and I published a book of, I don't know if you know that I published a book, a music book.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Book of my musician. Thurston Moore and I got together, and he edited a book of my music pictures, and they're all black and white. It's like 250 so pages of black and white.
Yeah, I love the title. I love the title. You know, should have seen what I've heard. It's such a great.
It's a line from Bo Diddley's "Who Do You Love?"
Oh, great!
We were racking our brains to come up with a title, and I was in this apartment. And I had Bo Diddley on playing, and suddenly that line popped out, and I said,
"Perfect,
perfect."
Yeah,
oh, what a great story.
Just what I've seen. So anyway.
That's just perfect. That makes so, like, when I saw the title, I was like, that's just perfect. Like, that's perfect for a, you know, a music book.
Totally.
Well, I live for many of the years that I lived here, downstairs was one of the best jazz bars in the city.
Oh,
I mean, right below my darkroom here. So I had piano, this great jazz piano music. All the great jazz pianists came to this bar called Bradley's downstairs. And Charles Mingus was there, all not playing, but all the time watching. Wow. I mean, all the great jazz people came to this bar. So all night, and I worked all night, always, in the dark room, I'd have this music playing until like 4 in the morning.
Wow.
So it was really great. Now it's a rock and roll. Now it's a sports bar.
Of course
not
it is.
Not the same. Yeah, I know.
Man. What was your turnaround like when you were out shooting and stuff like that? Like, what was your turnaround like back then? Would you, you know, leave a shoot, get back home, you know, pop the caps off the film and start developing? Or was it?
That's kinda what I would do. But usually not until late at night. Because I said I had partners here.
I had a
life with them. So after hours, you know, after they'd go to bed, that's when I would work. Which is the way it was growing up. All my childhood, I had three siblings and two parents in the house, and also a woman who lived with us who took care of us, sort of.
Yep.
My parents were very social, and I had to wait till everyone went to bed before I could work. I don't know why, but that's the way I was. I did my homework late at night, so I never really got tons of sleep. But so I've always worked that way. I've always worked late at night, and you know, I would have to. You know, I was pretty much working every day, especially at The Voice, you know, because I was doing so many different things within the paper.
Yeah.
You know, restaurant reviews, portraits.
Right.
I even photographed off the TV for the TV review.
Yeah, yeah, yes. I love that. I love that one in the doc. That. Yeah, that was so cool.
That made it much more fun. Everything, the whole idea was to make everything fun for me.
Right.
And that included when I worked on, did stills on movies. Everything was about making the job much more fun than it would normally be. And so I wouldn't turn into a hack.
Right.
I was incredibly lucky because I had great editors who totally trusted me. I would develop the film. First of all, I own everything I ever shot.
That's what I wanted to say. Yeah.
Incredible.
I kept everything I ever shot here in this room, actually, until I had so much I had to get a storage locker. But
yeah.
But, yeah. Basically, I kept everything. And own everything, because when I was at Harper's, I was staff director at Harper's Bazaar, and I would see them throwing out negatives. Normally in a staff position, you would at a major publication, you would turn over the film to them. They would process it and they would file it or keep it or do whatever they're going to do with it.
Right.
But because I did all my own processing, I kept everything here.
Was there ever any like questioning on that? Were they ever trying to get you to hand over the negs?
I never signed contracts or anything.
So
there was never any question of anyone owning the film except the the negatives like me.
Wow.
And plus the fact for 40 or so years, as long as I was working for somebody, they paid for everything. They paid for paper, the film, the chemicals, and everything, including the film that I would carry into the street to take pictures for myself.
Man.
So,
dream.
That is
it was,
the dream.
Yeah, it was like a foundation grant for 40 years.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
In my own Guggenheim. But it was an incredible gift. But the main gift I had was working with fantastic editors who totally trusted me, and I would only bring in the print I wanted. They would see contacts if they wanted to, but most of the people I worked with totally trusted me. I mean, where in a case where I would have to show them something, normally I would have to show them something. I found that I didn't have to. I'd just bring in the print I wanted. Which is another, you know, something kind of unheard of in a way.
Unheard of, yeah.
And well, if I worked for Vanity Fair, yes, I'd have to give them pictures. Freelance jobs, things like that.
Right.
But, and I was a terrible hustler. So
it's hard.
In terms of digging up work.
Yep.
So it was great that I had, you know, these benefactors, these staff positions, where I was, you know, I had health benefits, I had everything covered,
That's crazy.
I didn't have to think about the hard part. All I had to think about was, you know, getting somewhere and taking pictures.
So did your relationships with the editors start out that way, where they were always like, oh, it's James, we know, we don't have to look at his stuff, he'll
Well, coincidentally, two of the places I worked, that paper, The Herald,
yep,
and The Village Voice, for many years, a very good friend of mine that I met at Pratt,
yeah,
was the art director.
Right.
Wow.
Well, he was one of my best friends, too. And he happened to love photographs. And he and my co-photographer, staff photographer at The Voice, Sylvia Plocky,
yes,
he was a gift to us because he would never crop our pictures. He would treat all the pictures with respect. He loved photographs. He loved photography. He loved illustrators. Mm. And he just treated the work with the utmost respect, which was just wonderful.
Yeah.
And at Harper's Bazaar, I was hired by a woman named Bea Feitler, who worked with Avedon and was a fantastic art director. And she hired me when I got hired at Harper's Bazaar at a time when they decided that they were going to make it more newsy,
yeah,
you know, like up to date thing. They were kind of capitalizing on the idea of that Women's Wear Daily had of being, you know, up to the minute news. So they hired me with the idea that I would photograph millions of parties, which I love doing, actually.
Yeah, that worked out great.
And fashion shows, not fashion per se, but right, fashion shows, and portraits. So I did lots and lots of portraits, and I had the entree to photograph anybody I wanted that came to town, so I became a collector of portraits.
Yeah.
I loved meeting people making portraits, especially people in the arts. So that's how I tell the story. That's how I met Alfred Hitchcock, because they weren't particularly interested in him, but I knew that he was in town to promote the movie Frenzy at the time. And I knew that he always stayed at the St. Regis Hotel. So I went there. I mean, I had them arrange something, but I went there and there was, you know, no handlers, no publicity people nothing. Just he and his wife in a hotel room for you know, a few hours.
Wow.
You know, ordering up tea and having a fantastic afternoon.
Oh my God.
With my favorite director.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Just when I saw those photos too, my dad, huge Hitchcock fan, brought me up on those movies, you know, The Birds, Rear Window, all that stuff. I mean, legend.
Recently they had a show, they presented the film uncropped in a theater that had burned down in Sag Harbor, which is out in the end of Long Island. And they rebuilt the theater, and it's like state of the art.
Wow.
Fantastic theater with three screens. It's beautiful theater. Mm. Three screens, great projection, great sound, and a lounge, a full bar, and a quite a large, beautiful gallery. And so they showed the film last Good Friday, and also and I had a huge show of all my film, or a lot of my film people, also my film stills in the third floor gallery of this theater. And it's great, and it's going to be up for a couple months. So it was great. The whole experience was great. And they also said, you know, that you can show, are there any films you want to show that you like? And I said, well, in the film, I mentioned Rear Window, speaking of Hitchcock.
Yeah.
And I saw that when I was 8 years old. It was a huge influence on me. I am living in the neighborhood where the film takes place.
Oh, no kidding.
The exact neighborhood.
Wow.
And as a matter of fact, when I mentioned the Alberta Hotel in the film, he says to Raymond Burr Thorwald, the murderer, he says, I'll meet you at the bar at the Albert Hotel, which is right across the street from me. So I didn't even pick this apartment, but I incidentally wound up in the same neighborhood as Jimmy Stewart lived.
Yeah.
In the movie Rear Window. And so there are actually all kinds of coincidences, but
yeah,
you know,
kismet.
When I saw that film, of course I fell in love with Grace Kelly.
Right.
But and I envied the life of somebody, not necessarily a photographer, because I didn't know anything about photography, but But I envy the life of somebody who did not know what they were doing from day to day. And that was the life I wound up having.
Wow.
And which was fantastic. Speaking of Hitchcock.
Yeah. Yeah.
You talk about in the movie where you ended, it was like you and the journalists were kind of a team where you would work on pieces together. Was that?
I often did.
Yeah. Was that, was it? The journalist saying, this is what I want to do. James, will you come take the photos? Did you ever say, oh, I have this idea? Or I guess with like people that you wanted to photograph, you would kind of say like, I want to photograph Hitchcock. Can we write a piece about it? How often did that go back and forth?
Well, George Romero, when I told you about George Romero, I suggested it to a film critic at The Voice, and he did the interview on the phone. And I went to Pittsburgh. So sometimes I would be with a writer and sometimes I'd be on my own.
Right.
But the writers were friends. Yeah. So, especially at The Voice, very close friends. So, it was never a case of, even really discussing what we were going to do. We just did it.
And I
photographed what they were interested in, and they would talk about what I was photographing. So it all worked together very well. Yeah, it was great working alongside friends. And so not only were the editors friends, but the writers were friends.
Yeah. To bounce off people is like the best, you know, and just I feel like you guys must have been buzzing all the time. Just like
it was an amazing place. You know, there's a book out now called The Freaks Came Out to Write.
I got to write this down.
About the history of the Village Voice. It's an oral history.
Wow.
It's not much about the photography at all, really, but it is about the writing. And you get a taste of what it was like, a real taste of what it was like by reading that. But the Voice was a fantastic place, but every place I worked was, it was, I was extremely lucky to have great people to work with.
So you were at The Voice the longest, right? Is that where you were, you kind of did your longest stint?
Yeah, I was at The Voice for 20 years. I was at the New York Observer for 15.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Wow.
Yeah. And the other place, Harper's Bazaar, I was there for about 3 years. Yeah. 3 years for each of the other places, or two and a half, 3 years, something like that. But longest, so it was five staff jobs.
How things are so different now. Like, how was being paid back then? Now, was that something like you were paid per job? Did you have a salary? Like, how did you make ends?
Salary.
Okay.
Yeah, it was a salary. Freelance was per job, but salaried. Yeah. I worked the freelance jobs were mostly, I worked for Vanity Fair. Mm-hmm. I did a lot of work for New York Magazine, a lot of work. Mm. As a matter of fact, that's why I changed cameras.
Mm. Let's talk about that.
Do I talk about that?
No.
Well, yeah, I mean, I hated that they, I did a lot of full page pictures and covers and things like that. And it's an 8.5 by 11 magazine, as most of them were. And I guess I'll get a camera that suits the format. So I got a Pentax 645.
I love that
camera. So they wound up not cropping my pictures because they didn't have to. For the 35mm they would crop. So I started using that and fell in love with that camera.
It's a great camera.
That was sometime in the mid 80s. And, you know, it was kind of a clunker, but in a way.
Yeah.
We had the Nikon F, but I totally fell in love with the quality, the quality of 645, and the format is beautiful too. I like the frame. So, so that became my camera from like 86 on, I think.
How many of those do you think you probably owned?
I have a house out in the end of Long Island. I've always had a house out in the end of Long Island in East Hampton. Either I rented or bought. I finally bought, but I rented for many years out there. So I had to have a camera out there, I thought. So I had one there. I have three Pentax 645s, a lot of Nikon bodies I have.
Just before we move on to the, I wanted to ask you about them cropping your images. Why, in case somebody's listening that doesn't understand why cropping an image kind of bums you out, like what is it about cropping the image?
Well, for me, it was because I had an art background, I cared about composition a lot. Even spontaneously shooting in the street, somehow I managed to compose pictures very well, fast and well. Mm. So, I mean, and in those days, of course, you had no idea what you were going to get until you came home. And
Right.
2 days later, you'd see the film, which was a surprise and a treat and all that. but you weren't really sure. But I would see in the negatives after I processed them, that, and then subsequently the prints, that I know why I lifted the camera and shot when I did. It was that kind of thing.
Right.
It was often after the fact that I would know why I had this or that or this or that element in the frame. So I cared very much about the frame, and it was a game to me to not have to crop
maybe a discipline.
It was a discipline and a game to get it all in one frame. And the Nikon F was and the Pentax, you know, gave you 100% of what you were going to get pretty much. So I was maybe a little rigid because I didn't like to crop, but again, it was more fun and more challenging to not have to do that and to really get what I wanted in the frame.
That's a great way to like get good too, is make it a game.
Yeah, you got to pay attention to the whole thing.
Exactly. No spray and pray, you know.
Yeah, and I think the most important thing that somebody has to learn starting out is to get past the camera, really.
Ooh,
and so that you are, you know, as one with the camera as you can be,
right?
Pretty much knowing what you're going to get as instantaneously as you can, really. But just getting past the gear, you know, is vital, I think. And so if I ever taught photography, that would be part of what I would teach, I think, because I don't know if I'd want to judge people's work so much.
Right.
But I could teach them certainly the basics and darkroom if they cared. But and I think people do care. Some young people seem to care about darkroom now.
It's
which
all
is
coming back, James. It's crazy.
But especially at those prices.
But I know.
I think it's Tri-X. I don't know how much it is per roll. But again, I never had to buy it. So.
Yeah, you were.
Do you ever find any old rolls floating around? Or is there anything that's like not developed sitting in your...
I'm sitting next to a refrigerator with stuff. Actually, I have I have a refrigerator up here and then a wine cooler below it. And the wine cooler is where I keep all my chemicals because I can keep it at the right temperature.
Yeah.
And I have film in there that I've never developed. It's probably all fogged. I don't know. I should probably do it. It's not tons, but it's enough.
You'll never know. That could be like a little treasure in there.
Yeah. It would be fun to see, actually. It's 120 and 35 film.
Oh,
so
cool. Wow.
So I don't know. I don't know what's there. But I mean, if you can believe it, speaking of the 645, when I met Wes Anderson, I photographed Wes Anderson again.
Yeah.
So when I wanted to meet him after I saw Rushmore. And so I met him, and he eventually asked me to do stills on his films, or the films, some of the films. And starting with Royal Tenenbaums, I never wanted to get what the camera got. Which is what the studios cared about, because they wanted
marketing.
For publicity, they wanted basically what the camera got.
Yeah.
Right.
And, you know, with Wes's film particularly, you know, the camera is going to get only what he, you know, you can't, the film camera is never, the movie camera is never going to, I mean, you cannot replicate that exactly, because his films are so, his angles are so precise and all that. So, so what I would do is run in at the end of the scene and get pretty much what the camera would get, at least for the studio. But then even with that, I would make it a game, or treat it like a documentary film basically. And so that was what made it fun again, was making it my project, very much my project more than the studio's project, I think. So I would photograph what was going on behind the scenes much more than I would photograph what was, you know, in front of the camera.
That's the good stuff, though.
I told you that's kind of what I do out here in LA. I'm the, you know, on-set photographer, and I agree, like, the behind-the-scenes stuff is, like, where the magic is, you know, especially on a Wes Anderson film.
Yeah, right.
And I mean, they're all those great people, you know, and they're all friends, and it's a party, really, in a way. but just because they're friends. And everyone's wonderful, all the actors. So, and everyone likes to work with Wes. So, yeah, it was much more fun for me to treat it like a documentary project
right.
than a job. So, because it's long hours, and you know,
yep.
you know
yep.
what?
Yeah,
if you can't make it fun, there's no point in doing
right,
it.
Right, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
And it seemed like you know you became quite good friends with Wes, and I wanted to ask: is that how did this documentary kind of come about? Was it maybe his influence or other people?
It came about. Well, Wes and I had always talked about doing a book like the music book that Thurston and I did about filmmakers. And he was going to edit it. You know, we're racking our brains for a title and all that stuff. And, you know, made a selection of pictures. I had many more film people than I knew musicians. So it would be a big job to edit it. But then at a certain point, he said, no, we have to do the big book, you know, which is a Pandora's box. Because the big book would mean pictures from all categories, parts of my life. And then, you know, I have many more street pictures than anything, really.
Wow.
I mean, that was my big favorite subject for me was, you know, the surprise of what I would find in the street rather than what I would, you know, set up or anything like that. So it would be a huge project. And I could do several books easily,
right.
I think. I mean, in terms of having the material. So I don't know if we'll ever get around to doing that, but I send him a picture a day and have since the pandemic.
Oh, oh man.
That's
a different picture a day ever since the pandemic started. Well, it's just something. I also post pictures on Facebook pretty much every day.
Yeah, I was going to say that needs to be like a newsletter. You need to get people subscribed to that. Like,
or
we want
to.
Yeah,
Substack.
There you go. Yeah. Substack.
Yeah, I mean, really, I should. But since when the pandemic started, I had never been on Facebook at all. But I went on Facebook just to give myself a job, you know, because I'm pretty lazy, basically. and if I don't have a reason to do something, then I will, you know, goof off. But
me too.
And I needed to look back on the career because I was on a treadmill all those years, not being able to look back on anything.
Right.
So I had to, my work was very organized in terms of I knew where to find things, but it was not edited really or anything like that. So I started with my street work, which I call my random pictures, and because that would be the hardest to track down because I would only file that stuff under the month I did it. Month and the year I did it. So I had to, so that was the first stuff I wanted to digitize. And I hate scanners, so I'd actually photograph every frame.
Oh, perfect.
Do I talk about that in the film? I don't know.
I don't think so. No, I don't think so.
I put together a bunch of things from eBay to attach to my camera, my Nikon digital camera. It's a D7100. And then I got an old negative carrier off eBay.
Yep.
Slide the film in. Rest the tube. I have a tube and an extender and all this other stuff on the camera. And I rest that lens, that camera. I tape the lens focus. I tape the focus of the lens so it's always in the same focus.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I shoot it at f8 at a 60th and I photograph every frame that I want to.
Yeah.
And I can knock off hundreds in a weekend.
It's much faster.
It's very fast.
So much faster.
And then I invert them in Lightroom and make work on them. So, and then I might, you know, either make prints or whatever. But it's just to digitize, you know, everything. So I have it at least in that, you know, so I can see it.
Yeah, like in a whole nother archiving thing you got to go through now, right? You've got to like digitize everything.
Right.
Wow.
That's right. So I started with the street stuff, and then I moved on to portraits and so on. I've still got a long, 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 long way to go.
Yeah.
But I've done most of the 70s and 80s street stuff. I haven't moved on yet into the 90s yet.
Man, I want to see this work. You need to get a book. I want to see it.
I know.
I want to see it.
Well, join me on Facebook.
Yes, I will. I'm hopping over there then.
We were kind of, Timothy and I were talking kind of about like your, you know, in the film you talk about like journalism going away and stuff like that. And one of the things you said is you were never interested in hanging photos on a wall to never like get the notoriety or, you know, somebody what
it,
said
it,
like.
It just never, it just kind of never occurred to me. I mean, I only have, at my house, I only have two pictures on the wall that are mine. And that's just for decoration, really. But yeah, I mean, it's just that I never joined with a gallery or anything like that. And not because I wouldn't have wanted to, and I'd like to sometime, but I was, you know, everything was in print, you know, and so I was, that was satisfying enough
good
in
enough,
a way.
Right.
I bet. Yeah.
And again, it was everything. They're all my choice. So
yeah, that's crazy. That's so crazy.
So it's just So it's just that I never particularly imagined the stuff on the wall. That's all.
And do you think maybe you will now?
Well, I have this show out in Sac Harbor, which was actually, it's only the second show I ever had. When the book came out, the music book came out, we had a show down in a gallery, just as a kind of exhibition. For the premiere of the book kind of thing. That's the only other time I ever had a show.
That's crazy. Out of this whole long career, two little shows. Well, not little. I mean, just two shows. That's just pretty crazy. What I had a question about all of your archive and stuff. What's the plan for after you're gone? Have a plan? Is there a plan for that? Like, because I often wonder, like, what am I going to do with all my stuff? And I'm, you know, nobody in Central PA. I don't know. Hopefully it doesn't end up at, like, a Goodwill.
What's your plan?
I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, my most of my work, probably all of my work was based in, I mean, I've traveled, but most of my work was based in New York. So, I mean, if there's a New York institution, you know, that would be appropriate. But I don't know who takes care of this stuff, really. Yeah. I mean, I haven't really investigated, and I don't want my life partner Kathy to get stuck with it, because she has a friend whose husband died, a photographer, and now she's stuck with all this work to deal with, and that's a big job.
I
understand. So I don't know. I have to think about it. Obviously,
It's always a question on my mind when I think about stuff like that. And then to think of someone that has, I can only imagine the amount of negatives and prints and the stuff that you have. Like I used to
have a locker in town, storage locker. Well, what happened, incidentally, in this room, I had, as I say, many, many years of work. And then I decided, well, I have to get a locker. So I got a locker downtown in Manhattan and moved everything down there. I only had about I had about 5 or 6 years of work here in this in this room in file cabinets. I met maybe not even that much, but 2 weeks after I put all that stuff in a locker, I had a fire in this room.
Oh no!
And I was away. I was on my second margarita out in Long Island, and I got a call from the super of the building telling me that had been a fire in my apartment.
Oh, no.
And it was in the wall here of this dark room kitchen.
Oh my God.
And what the firemen did was they were out in the hallway and they burst through this wall to put it out. And it wasn't and they put out the fire very quickly. Somebody in the bar downstairs smelled smoke, alerted the fire. They came very quickly, but the damage was caused by the water.
Yeah,
because they hosed down the whole room. And if I had not moved those negatives 2 weeks before, you can imagine what would have happened.
Jeez.
It would have been the end of years and years of work.
How lucky! Jeez,
it's unbelievable.
That's good.
It's really unbelievable, but it was. Those 2 weeks that, you know.
Yeah, it's you know, with negatives, it's like, you know, they say with digital, have a hard drive at your house and have a hard drive at the office, have a hard drive like at your, you know, parents' house just in case. But when it's negatives, you can't, that's it. They're only in one spot.
Yeah, and again, I hadn't digitized anything at that point.
Oh,
you know, it was a few years ago. And my girlfriend, partner, many, many years, whom I met at the Boys, by the way.
cool
job. We met on the job, a stakeout, because she had done a story about the working girls of Williamsburg, and I was enlisted to go out with her and photograph the girls, and we met on a stakeout. Anyway, so she came here and gathered up the contacts that were damp and whatever negatives were. Anyway, she gathered up everything that was salvageable and took it to her apartment and her house, and laid it out all on the floor everywhere to dry. Yeah. And so she rescued an enormous amount of work, but I was a nervous wreck being, 100 miles.
Oh, I can imagine.
Oh, I bet.
So it was horrible.
Wow.
Yeah. But water damage, as bad as fire damage.
Yeah.
Or worse.
I did kind of want to ask you a little bit about, I'm not exactly sure when you stopped shooting and working for the different, newspapers, magazines, and all that stuff, but were you seeing a decline in print media before you were done shooting? Because, again, I think we talked about a little bit of where, watching your I can't wait for everyone to see this documentary. I mean, it's just so inspiring. It's just a great story. I mean,
That would be the best effect if it's inspiring, because I love that.
But, oh, dude, I can't even tell you. I mean,
I love the idea of that, of course. But, as you know from the film, I was kind of knocked out of the game because I was run over.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah.
And so I was basically unable to walk properly, at all for quite a while, but not properly for 4 years.
Oh.
So I lost the job that day working for the New York Observer.
Mm.
It had already turned into what I say is sort of a real estate rag, because Jared Kushner bought it.
Yep.
And it was a lot about, very much about real estate and that sort of thing. And I was no longer doing two pictures a week that I wanted. It was down to one picture a week that was always had to be a portrait.
Mm.
And they basically were cutting salaries. I mean, it was really turning into what eventually happened to a lot of journalism, where, they were using, services for pictures. They weren't paying a lot of money. They cutting back on, in health insurance, everything you can think of started to happen. So it was the beginning, very much the beginnings of that kind of thing when it happened. That was 2009. So, I lost the job that day, essentially, and because it was, 4 years later, there was no more staff jobs to have in a way.
Yeah.
So I didn't go out for another staff job or try for anything else. So, your question is, was it beginning to happen then?
Yeah.
Yes, it was beginning to happen then. And it happened to The Voice. It happened to a lot of, alt media papers, as far as I know, that did. I mean, The Voice still has a presence online, but barely. And that's kind of the way it was. But, when I was, most of the time I was working there, it was a fat paper, a lot of pages, a lot of pictures, a lot of everything. I mean, it was really a valuable resource for New Yorkers.
What a time.
Just sad.
Yeah, what a time.
Sad. Yeah, just watching your story, I'm like, man, that is the dream right there. Like the dream, working for a paper, going on assignment.
I think in the film, I think your partner mentions how like young photographers today are like, that's the dream. That's what we want. It's like, it looks different for us. It really does.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you've been in LA to have read the LA Weekly. Does that still exist?
I think so.
Does that still exist?
It used to be they used to have the paper boxes, on the street where you can just like pull one out.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I don't think I've seen one in
a
while.
I bet it's all online now.
It's probably all online.
The Voice went free, and it was free in those paper boxes. Those
I haven't come across one in a while now that I think about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll be right back with listener question for James right after this message from our sponsor.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Just wanted to pop in here quick and let you guys know about our Patreon-only Develop and Hang Nights. Now, we've done a bunch of these already. They're a ton of fun. We talk shop. We develop some film. We laugh. We also try to get a former guest for these. Now, if that sounds like something you're interested in, head over to patreon.com/analogtalk. Like we say, Patreon is the best way to support the show. Thanks, guys.
All right, guys, this is part of the show where we take a question from one of our listeners. And this week's question comes from Caitlin Bagwell. And they ask, what's the wildest thing you've caught on camera? Which, with a career like yours, I can't imagine what the thing
is. That is really a tough thing. Wildest, I don't think speaks to my experience covering wars.
Sure.
So
yeah.
I won't go into that. There was one job I did where it was a freelance job, actually, for the New York Times Magazine, where I there was a tour. It was sort of like, the circus has a red circus and a blue circus where they do one part of the country red, one part of the country blue. And so somebody decided that there was not enough G-rated entertainment. So he invented, there's a guy named Roy Radin, and he invented a bus tour that would go around to movie theaters all over the East Coast and even farther west, and present this G-rated entertainment, which was basically a vaudeville show. And it was almost like in this bus, and I was on the bus photographing the people as part of the show. And it was sort of like a ghost ship because these were people that had their day in show business. Names that a lot of people won't recognize, probably. Georgie Jessel was the host of the tour I was on. Eddie Fisher was on the show. Frank Fonda. These are people from the past. There was an Elvis impersonator. There were the group called the Drifters. There were Danny and the Juniors. These are all people from 50s rock and roll. And so... And Jackie Vernon. It was basically the strange ghost ship of old time performers, and Tiny Tim, if you remember. And so it was the kind of job where you are laughing so hard you can't catch your breath. Not only at what was not at very much of what was going on, but it was also at the people and how and what they had to say and everything. Donald O'Connor was there, and it was just a very strange, hilarious, bizarre thing. And Roy Radin wound up plying everybody with cocaine. And in fact, had this mansion in Southampton, Long Island, right on the beach. And he famously had a dungeon in the basement.
Oh, my goodness. What?
In quotes, dungeon. And where he would have these orgies. So cocaine orgies on the beach.
Sounds
on the
about
beach
right.
In a mansion in Long Island. And this tour of basically has-beens. traveling the country. And I was along for the ride.
Wow.
And the whole thing was just
wild,
hilarious,
wild and
hilarious. So I guess that qualifies. I've had many circumstances, but for some reason that came to mind only because it was out of control, and I felt like I was in the middle of this maelstrom of craziness, and something that would never happen again.
It's like one of those, like, how did I get here, right? Like, what?
Well, then he wound up getting involved in, this dates it actually, because he got involved with Robert Evans and Francis Coppola when they did Cotton Club. Wow. And he decided that he wanted to, you know, play with the big boys, and also got involved with a cocaine dealer in Hollywood, and was wound up murdered in the desert.
Oh, no way.
Whoa.
Yeah, by a woman named Lainey Jacobson and her gang.
What a crazy story.
Yeah.
Wow.
It is a very crazy story.
That's a great answer to that question.
It's just one of many crazy experiences.
Wow.
When I photographed Jerry Lee Lewis, he threw a knife at me.
No way. Wow.
Well, I photographed him performance in New York, in a club in New York, actually. And he gave a great performance. And then I went backstage to photograph him. And I walk in and he's stripped to the waist. and I realized he was completely drunk and had been for the entire performance.
God.
So, but he, you know, he managed to, you know, he can handle it.
Yeah.
When I didn't know he was drunk, but he was. And I'm sitting there across the room loading my film, and all of a sudden a knife whizzes right past me and into the wall. And then he, you know, does one of those laughs. And I knew it was going to be maybe downhill from there. But actually, we got along okay. But the picture I have, and I don't know if you've seen it. Is it? Maybe it's in the, I think it's in the film. Anyway, he's looking very severe and scary.
See, what I love about that story, James, is like, that's a crazy story, but it's Jerry Lee Lewis who threw that at you, you know?
That's right.
That's the crazy.
Who's also known as the killer, you know?
Yeah.
And then another time, a reporter and I, Joe Connison, decided that we wanted to cover the Teamsters convention in Las Vegas at Caesar's Palace. And so we once again, you know, did this sort of forgery thing where we pretended we were working with the union paper, whatever that was, and crashed this event because there were no photographers there. And there's a picture that I love that I took there of Jackie Presser, the Teamsters boss, being carried in on a litter by Centurion guards, dressed up as Centurion guards. That's in the film.
And
Caesar's Palace. And that was kind of a shot heard around the world when that picture came out, because a lot of unions wanted a copy of it, you know.
Wow.
It was somewhat scandalous and humorous and satiric and so on.
The things you've seen.
Yeah.
Jeez.
I mean, I could really go on. I just haven't racked my brains about it yet. But anyway.
That's more than
yeah. Those were three really good ones, though. I'm my face hurts from laughing and smiling. There, that was good.
Okay, we have one more question for you. This is a two-parter. This is if you had to pick one camera to use for the rest of your life, you're stranded on a desert island. That this is all you could bring. What would it be and why?
Well, if I'm stranded on a desert island, it can't be a phone camera.
So
that's
we always
the problem.
Say it's magical. You can. It's just whatever magical camera you can't live without.
Well, you know, I would probably go back to my Nikon
F. Right.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, as much as I love the Pentax, I love 36 frames on a roll, you know?
Right.
Mostly I used the Pentax because I wanted that quality, and I was doing lots and lots and lots of portraits. So I don't. It'd be one or the other. It's hard for me to say no to the Pentax as well. But
it's tough.
I sure did love that Nikon.
Yeah.
Mm, two awesome cameras.
But nowadays I use a very small digital camera that I also love, which is the Ricoh GRT.
I was wondering what you were shooting in the dock.
Yeah.
And subsequent models don't have of that camera do not have a flash on them, and I like the fact that it does have a flash on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is, you know, in a pinch you need a flash. I carry a flash around with me anyway that fits it, but but it's nice to have one directly on the camera. But that's a great street camera. It's a Pix 28 millimeter lens, but I love using that camera. If you're giving me all the film I want and all the chemicals I want and all that, then I'll be happy to use my Nikon F.
Legendary.
There's a second part of this question. Is there any cameras that you haven't tried in your career that you're looking to try or get, or are you satisfied with what you got?
Well, I actually have a 4x5 Graflex camera that I've only used a few times. I'd like to use that more, but there's no camera that I can think of that I would like to. I mean, I wonder what it would be like to use the Nikon monochromatic camera. I wonder, because a friend of mine has one. I'd like to give that a try just to see how different it is actually using a monochromatic digital camera.
Yeah. I've never tried that too. Yeah, it'd be neat to, because I'm a black and white guy, you know.
As you can
tell. I don't know if you could tell.
Oh, you are. But you're black and white now, actually.
Yeah. I love the constraint of it. You don't have to think about anything other than the shot when you're shooting black and white.
Yeah, and I see black and white.
I say that all the time.
If I'm using color film, I'm thinking in color, but certainly most of the time, since I didn't shoot much color anyway, I see in black and white.
Definitely.
Well, James, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much. Yeah. What a career. We're excited for the documentary. Congratulations on that. Where can everybody, give us some information, where can everybody see that? When's it, do you know the...
Well, it's in New York, it's playing, as a sneak preview on Thursday the 25th, and then it begins... this is all at the IFC Center in New York City on 6th Avenue in the Village. And officially premieres on the 26th, and it'll be played for, I don't know how long, actually, at least a week or so. And then it's going to be playing at the Lemley Royale in L.A. And I guess other theaters around, but I don't know. I think that's going to be playing in Vancouver or something. Anyway, somewhere in the Northwest. But... you know, I guess stay tuned, but then eventually it will be online.
Yeah.
I mean, streaming.
Well, we could post it up when.
We'll make sure to link all that.
If you would, that'd be great.
Yeah, we'll make sure everybody knows where they can check it out once it's available. Because we saw it again last night, and it's...
You should see it on a big screen.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
It's really...
I want to.
We'll put it everywhere.
It's really... If you want to see it again, really, it's wonderful on the big screen.
Totally.
Much, much better, right?
Fantastic. James, thank you again. This was so lovely to meet you again.
Thank
Congratulations.
You, Paul. Thank you.
Yeah, we'll see you guys next time.
First off, Kristen, I would love to thank James for coming on the show. What an honor to get to interview you and talk about this documentary and your legendary career. I mean, what an inspiration. James, thanks so much for taking the time. Everybody, make sure you go out and see that doc. Guys, that's going to take us to Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/analogtalk. For only $1, you can get the show 2 days early. We also have our Patreon-only develop and hang over there and a bunch of stuff in the archives. Like we always say, Patreon is the best way to support the show. And for the patrons that already support the show, guys, we do not know what we would do without you. Thank you so much. All right, that's going to wrap up this episode. Again, thanks, James. Guys, go see the doc. I believe it is released online. You can watch it now. We'll try to get the links in there for you so everybody can check it out. What a career. What an honor. All right, guys, until the next one, we will see you soon with an all new episode. Later.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.